Okay, so it is good to see everyone, and as Malki said, learning together is something that we can do to you know, unite when things get crazy in the world and in the Jewish world. So last week we began our discussion on the role of non-local halachic issues, of policy issues in terms of how they shape psak, in terms of both internal to the halachic system and external, meaning how they shape the way we might decide what the halacha is, and how we might say that even when something is not technically a halachic question, we still have something to say about it from a halachic perspective, or from a Torah perspective more broadly, perhaps. And then we transitioned into the question of, okay, even if we've established that it is legitimate to make policy statements, especially of the form of, non-fallacious, slippery slope arguments, meaning not X will inevitably lead to Y, but X might lead to Y, and Y is a bad thing to do, and therefore we're going to try to safeguard ourselves from it. Whether we need to be honest about what we're doing or not. Where on the one hand, when it comes to biblical law, or more precisely, rabbinic law, whether we have to acknowledge that it's rabbinic law as a protective measure over the Torah, or we can pretend that it's biblical. So the Rambam went as far as to say that to present rabbinic law as if it were biblical would be a violation of the law of Baal Tosif, to not add to the Torah. And what allows you to make the policy decisions that are inherent in rabbinic law is the fact that you're honest about it, the fact that you're upfront about it. Where on the other hand, we saw the intuition that emerges or drives the Maharil's comments that the opposite is the case, that he thinks that often the rabbis explicitly hid their true intent using asmachta, right? Using psukim to hang the rabbinic law on. And unlike the Rambam, who thinks that that's maybe a mnemonic that helps you remember or something like that, the Maharil thinks that the original intent of hanging these on psukim were to trick people. Because we want you to take policy decisions made by the rabbis, or what we call rabbinic law, seriously. And the best way to make you take it seriously is by pretending that it is biblical law. So we have these two very different intuitions about whether the best way to deal with policy is to pretend that it's halakha, thereby adding extra layers of protection to the law, or the best way is to be honest and acknowledge this is the primary law, this is the biblical, and this is the rabbinic law. Now, before we turn to the next source, I just want to make sort of an introductory comment to it, which is the following. The local dispute that we discussed at the end of last week is limited to pretending that biblical law is in fact rabbinic law. But often when we're talking about policy, and we're talking about rabbis making policy decisions, we're not talking about that, right? We're not talking about rabbis who are writing rabbinic law. And then the question is, do they acknowledge that it's rabbinic law, or do they tell you that it's biblical law? We're talking about rabbis who might be dealing with a rabbinic question, and the question is, do they acknowledge that it's forbidden, or let's say permitted rabbinically, but a bad idea, or do they pretend that it's rabbinic? Now, technically, that doesn't violate the Rambam's rule, right? The Rambam's rule is very locally, when I pretend that a rabbinic law is in fact biblical law, so then I have violated Baal Tosif. But ostensibly, according to the Rambam, if I pretend that my personal policy feeling is rabbinic, that's not a violation of Baal Tosif, right? Because I'm not adding to biblical law. I'm pretending that my policy is in fact rabbinic law. And often I think the more heated disputes in our community are about that, right? They're not about biblical law, right? They're about, you know, this has come up several times. We've mentioned several times in passing. If you read it all Israeli, you know, Israeli news, you'll know that in my hometown, well, where I live now, this exploded. Well, I don't know if it exploded, but it's been the topic of conversation again. But women's issues, this is often the case. Right? So, for example, if you talk about the question of women reading the Torah, let's say, that's a rabbinic law to begin with, right? So, obviously, no one is arguing that it's that a woman reading the Torah is a violation of biblical law. What biblical law would that be? The whole thing is rabbinic, right? So, there, the dispute is more locally, is this a violation of rabbinic law? Or is it not even a violation of rabbinic law, it's just policy? So sure, technically, the Rambam's position isn't relevant here. But I think the ethos behind this is, meaning the question of whether the better way to deal with policy is by being open and saying, this is my political, right, this is my assessment of the community, my sociological assessment of the community, but not what I think the law is, or do I say, no, I do my best, as the Chatam Sofer said, to wrap everything in the language of law to strengthen it, right, those intuitions, even when not formally relevant, are still practically relevant in the way Poskim follow it. You know, and like I said, these things are perennial questions, meaning I'm sure at least some of you have heard that one of the shuls in one of the other neighborhoods here in Efrat, as the news put it, were the first, quote, right, the first Orthodox shul to appoint a woman rabbi, right? So, you know, this is obviously, right, back in the conversation. How do people feel about it? What are they, right? Is it permitted? Is it forbidden? Why is it problematic? Is it not problematic? Is it good, right? And these same conversations obviously are going to come up again and constantly, whether it's in my community or anyone else's community. So having an idea of how we talk about it and how we distinguish between law and policy and what we think is good a good idea and things like that, is really what we want to focus on today. So we're going to start, therefore, with a bit of history, because I think it's always helpful to remember that as much as we feel like the questions we're facing are sometimes new, even when they're new, they're often not unprecedented, right? We use that word unprecedented a lot. And it's a problem, because then we sort of cut ourselves off from history. Like, I know, forget halacha for a second, right? When people have been talking about COVID, they're talking about an unprecedented, unprecedented pandemic. This is not an unprecedented pandemic. We haven't experienced it in a while, but it's not unprecedented. And that's an important point, because if you think it's unprecedented, then you think the past has nothing to teach you. If you realize that we just haven't seen it recently, history might have something to teach you. It happens to be that it's, you know, and it's really not unprecedented at all. Meaning, if you have any historical sense, you'll know that pandemics were more the norm. Definitely epidemics were the norm. Pandemics were not out of the normal. You know, the last few months I've read several books on different pandemics of sorts, the great influenza. But to be fair, I grew up on this, meaning my mother is an epidemiologist, and she's worked in this her whole life and was called out of retirement for COVID, specifically because it is not unprecedented, because, you know, if you've been dealing with, you know, infectious disease as an epidemiologist, so then, you know, you actually have experience. The same thing is true with halacha. You know, we tend to think that we lose historical sense, and therefore we might not remember to look at history for guidance. So here I turn to the 19th century. And in an excellent article by Michael Silber, when I was in YU, my professor who first introduced me to this article, Professor Deborah Kaplan, said that in her opinion, this is the single greatest article of early modern scholarship ever written in Jewish studies. I definitely don't have the breadth of knowledge to say whether that's true, but it's definitely a very good article. So Michael Silber writes an article called The Emergence of Ultra-Orthodoxy, The Invention of a Tradition. And he brings our focus to the 19th century when, as we began discussing last week, the Jewish world was trying to deal with the responses to reform, right, to the creation of a new movement within Judaism. And there were basically two responses, two main responses within the world of Orthodoxy. There was the approach represented by the German school. There were nuances in it, but for the moment we'll elide those differences. But there was the movement within the German school, people like Rav Hirsch and Rav Hildesheimer, who felt that the proper way to deal with it was to stand strong on halachic issues, but on more cultural issues like should you give the drasha in the vernacular or in Yiddish? Should you wear modern clothes, or did you have to wear, you know, what we always wore? Things like that. On things like that, it was totally legitimate to be modern, as it were. And then there was the school of the Chatam Sofer, the Hungarian school, where they felt that the proper approach was to double down on everything. Halacha, rabbinic law, biblical law, and minhagim. Every practice, everything, nothing could change. And this was the approach of the Chatam Sofer, who captured it in his famous misappropriation of the line, which has nothing to do with this. It has to do with whether you can eat new grain. But chadash asur min haTorah, that anything which is new is biblically forbidden. But that was only the beginning, because the Chatam Sofer had some students, and his students were, at least some of them, more extreme and radical than the Chatam Sofer, than Rav Moshe Sofer. And two of his students, who were particularly aggressive, named Rabbi Hillel Lichtenstein and Rabbi Akiva Schlesinger, decided that it wasn't just enough for them to criticize the German school, right, the neo-Orthodox school, as it's called in some of the academic literature. But they convened a Beit Din to issue a formal psak, a formal halachic ruling explaining why everything they were doing, using the vernacular, changing how they dressed, was a violation of biblical law. Now again, this is not their criticism of reform. This is their criticism of the modern Orthodox, neo-Orthodox, whatever it was, the German Orthodox approach, right? They're not even bothering to fight with the reform. This is their way of fighting with reform is doubling down even within those in the traditional community who are willing to make any changes. So they convened this, this Beit Din, and they issue a psak, and I'm going to skip to this, called the Psak Din of Michalovka. I'm not pronouncing that fully correctly, but okay. In 1865. And this is what happens. Here's what Silber summarizes. The preference for the spirit, The preference for the spirit over the letter of the law was best illustrated by the Psak Din of Michalovka. Serious problems faced the ultra-Orthodox when they sought to provide the rationale for the nine prohibitions, right? Those are the prohibitions of changing your name and changing your clothes and things like that. As its name suggests, the Psak Din was intended to be a halachically based ruling. Mainstream Orthodox authorities, however, refused to sanction it, as such, because of his extreme pronouncements, in response to Hillel Lichtenstein's preliminary draft of the Psak Din, Rabbi Moshe Schick, who was to become the leading halachic authority of Hungarian Jewry in the 1870s, wished him success, but balked at endorsing the Psak with its claim of being grounded in halacha. Quote, when it comes to determining the din, love truth and avoid flattery. Were these prohibitions formulated as emergency measures, migdar milta? And further, if he could be convinced of their efficacy, he would not be averse to lending his support. As it stood, however, the Psak Din was misleading, and Lichtenstein could not count upon his signature. And indeed, when the Psak Din was issued a few months later, more or less in its original form, Schick, like most mainstream Orthodox rabbis, refrained from signing it. I saw there things in my opinion, which in my opinion were simply not true, he wrote to Rabbi Menachem Eisenstetter of Ungvar, who repeatedly pressured him to sign. If one intends to issue an emergency prohibition, he is not permitted to claim that it is by force of halacha that it is forbidden. And if a court were to do so, as this Psak Din, then according to Maimonides, it violates the injunction of thou shalt not add thereto, of Bal Tosif. So what happened? You had here, and this is what's amazing about, the reason I love this moment is because here you have two schools within the radical Haredi camp, meaning the Maharam Schick was known as a zealot. He wasn't known for being, the Maharam Schick was not afraid of a fight. He was not afraid of being extreme, and he agreed with the conclusions of Lichtenstein and Schlesinger, which was, you shouldn't change your language, you shouldn't change your dress, and all those things. But they differed in approach. And he said, I don't care what you say. You want to say something extreme? I even agree with you. But when you say it, you have to say what you mean. You think that we're under attack by the Reform, and therefore we need to be extreme in our formulation, and we need to take policies which are very extreme to protect ourselves? I will sign on that in a heartbeat. But you pretend that it's law? I'm out. Right? I'm out. Right? It's fine for you to make a policy decision, but admit that it is, right? Admit that it's policy. Don't pretend that it is law. If you pretend that it's law, then you are violating the Rambam's rule of Bal Tosif. I remember I mentioned this once in a shiur when I first moved to Toronto, and it was funny because after the shiur, someone in the shul came over to me, who is a Lichtenstein, and he said, wow, I'm so glad you gave that shiur because I never heard anyone quote my great-great-grandfather, and I've named my kids for their great-great-grandparents, for Hillel Lichtenstein and Akiva Schlesinger. So this isn't that long ago, right? He wasn't a kanoi at all. He was a very, very sweet man. He was just happy that I was naming him, I mentioned his children's namesake. And Silver goes on to talk about the impact of extra legal corpus, right? How much you incorporate Kabbalah, how much you incorporate Midrash, as part of the question here. But again, the main question that for me is fascinating is that you have here two sides who both agree that what's called for is an extreme policy decision to say that because we're under attack from the Reform, the proper thing to do is to ban the use of secular names, is to ban the use of the vernacular in shul, things which at first glance are not halachic. But they felt that in order to bolster traditionalism, they needed to double down on every single custom and every single thing which tied them to whatever. But they argued about whether you were allowed to lie. Right? Rabbi Zil Lichtenstein and Akiva Schlesinger said, every tactic in the book is legitimate to protect the Torah. And therefore, if I can somehow construe my policy as law, then that's legitimate. And the Maharam Shif says, no, I don't care what you say, I don't care how legitimate it is. If it's law, then it's law. And if it's your read of the social situation and what you think is a better idea, so you want to make a policy rule, then you have to acknowledge it. And if that weakens it, because people will listen to your psak, but they won't listen to your policy, then that's the cost for truth. Now we noted, and I'll just reiterate this. At a formal level, this may be limited to lying about rabbinic law and pretending that it's biblical law. And as we saw two shiurim ago, on a formal level, it may not even apply post the Beit Din, like the Beit Din in Yerushalayim. And Rav Henkin notes that according to many, he suggests that at a formal level, this rule only applies to the original Beit Din, and technically, we're not bound by it. And if you think you're bound to it, that may come down to the question that we discussed 3 weeks ago of whether modern rabbis carry the same authority as the Beit Din Yerushalayim of Lo Tasur. But regardless of whether it's formally true, the idea is equally important, right? The question of whether the right thing to do when you think something's wrong for the community but you don't think it's usher is to tell the truth or to lie, right? That remains true. And I'll open it for questions in just a second, but just to point this out, in addition to the question of Baal Tosif, right, of is it called adding to the Torah when you blur the line between policy and halakha, as many poskim have noted, I gave you the summary here from Rabbi Dov and Aryeh Frimer, there's a more mundane common law that may also be violated here, which is lying, right? Even if it's not Baal Tosif, lying about what the law really is and what you really mean might be forbidden because it's lying, and lying is usur. And there's a particular problem, not just of lying in general, but of lying in the context of Torah, because that's called Ziyufa Torah, which is misrepresentation of the law. So they note, and I'll just read their summary, they say, we turn now to the particular issue raised in the text at note 228, namely, does misrepresenting halakha and or giving an erroneous reason or source for a prohibition involve the violation of the prohibition against lying? Utsvir Chayes and Darkei Hora'ah argues that it's forbidden to call a rabbinic edict a biblical prohibition because it violates not only Baal Tosif, but also Midvar Sheker Tirchak, stay away from untruthfulness. This is also the opinion of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk, cited in Nefesh Hara. Rabbi Soloveitchik maintains that even Ravid agrees that Midvar Sheker Tirchak forbids the rabbis to claim that a rabbinic injunction is biblical. Accordingly, Rambam and Ravid disagree only whether it's permitted to be as stringent when dealing with a custom or rabbinic injunction as one would be were the prohibition biblical. Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, the Stifler, refuting the suggestion that it's forbidden to take part in elections in the secular state of Israel, writes, and your honor should know that even to be zealous, it is forbidden to teach Torah not according to the halakha. And that which is not true will not succeed at all. In an as-yet unpublished responsum to Aryeh Frimer, Rabbi Chaim David Halevi prohibits a posek from misrepresenting halakha and or giving an erroneous reason for a prohibition for two basic reasons. One, the biblical prohibition of Midvar Sheker Tirchak, and two, a total loss in rabbinic authority would result should the truth become known. See also related opinions, Ray Ehrenberg, Rogler, and Sobel cited below. But several poskim dissent, arguing on various grounds that Midvar Sheker Tirchak is not applicable to cases where halakha is misrepresented so as to prevent future violations of Jewish law. Some argue that the dispensation to modify the truth in order to maintain peace, Mishanim Mipnei HaShalom, also applies to misrepresenting halakha in order to maintain peace between Klal Yisrael and the Almighty. So what's amazing as they note, is that not only does this dispute happen on the level of Baal Tosef, but on the level of, is it a problem to lie, right, which should be much more expansive, because that should ban lying about policy over rabbinic law. I mean, anytime you're not being totally honest, some folks can say, of course you can't lie, right? I mean, that's just like basic, right, basic halakha. We all know you don't lie. You don't lie about anything. You definitely don't lie about Torah. But other poskim actually think, no, you are allowed to lie. Just like we say that you're allowed to maintain peace between people, as we know from like Aaron HaKohen, who would lie between friends and spouses to get them to make up, right, and to apologize. So if you're what you're trying to do is make peace between God and the Jewish people by getting people to keep halakha, everything is fair game. Lie, pretend that policy is law, pretend it's biblical law, do whatever you need. Just make sure that people do the right thing in the end of the day. Okay? So, let's pause. I want feedback. I'm not even going to say questions. I want feedback. What is your impression about this dispute, about whether the proper way to approach non-halakhic issues, things that the Poseg believes are important but not law, is the right thing to do? And by right, I'm going to include everything there. Right halachically, right ethically, right effectively, right politically, right in terms of pragmatism, is the right thing to do to be dishonest, less than honest, opaque in your decision-making process, right? Or honest, open, explicit. What are the costs, right? Pro and con, does it change? Is our moment in history different, right? Impressions. Malki.
Question on, before I even dive into that, was there any time in Tanakh where any of the Nevi'im did something similar? Like perhaps didn't tell the truth, but because they wanted the Bnei Yisrael to act a certain way, or I mean, is there precedent in that?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Do we have evidence in Tanakh? I'm trying to think. Like most of the people in Tanakh. Right. Sometimes they'll break the law, but do they lie about the law? Right. Like Eliyahu, the Gemara assumes is breaking the law. Right. That when he brings a karban on Har HaKarmel, the Gemara assumes he's breaking the law. He's uprooting the Torah temporarily to in order to get the Jews to do the right thing. But he's not lying. Right. So. Right. I mean. Arguably, that's more radical, right? Meaning he's breaking the law. He's bringing carbon where he can. So the Gemara says he's breaking the law, but lying, I don't know, right? Like you get, you know, it's one of those things. The Nevi'im don't really pull their punches in that sense, right? Like they're pretty straightforward. And so I don't know. I'm trying to think. Like Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Amos.
But what would be in preface what they say, Kama Hashem, the same as the Kama Kodesh Baruch Hu. So if they happen to believe it, then it's fine. They're not lying at all.
Right. I mean, right, you know, and however you think their Nevuah comes, right, because right, obviously their Nevuah is not Moshe's Nevuah, right? They're channeling God rather than quoting. But still, yeah, I mean, I can't think, you know, offhand of one where they're lying, right? We have a lot of instances where the Gemara assumes that people are breaking the law, in order, right, temporarily breaking the law, right? Eliyahu is one example. The Gemara has a discussion about Chizkiyahu when he brings the Karban Pesach, it seems in Iyar rather than in Nisan. So the Gemara there gets into the question of whether what he did was forbidden or permitted under the circumstances, and what exactly he did. But lying, I can't think of a case where they're lying. I can't offhand think of a case where they're lying.
There's So if there's no precedent in that, and a lot of, you know, what we do and how, I guess the Gemara is a lot of precedent, why and how could anyone think that lying would be a precedent to start? Mm-hmm. There must have been so many different, before the Reform Movement, there were other opportunities for Jews to be, you know, there were the Karaites were there.
It's an interesting question. Part of it in Tanakh, Tanakh is a little bit hard because, there are clearly times where the Nevi'im are saying things that don't seem to be in the Torah, but the question is, are they lying about it or are they simply introducing new principles, right? Like, Yeshayahu introduces new things about Shabbos that you wouldn't know. The Torah doesn't say explicitly, but it's hard to know, right, you know, in terms of, like, only speaking in a Shabbos-dick way, right? The Torah doesn't say that explicitly. Yeshayahu does. But the Ramban thinks it's implicit in the Torah. So it's very hard to figure out, like, is Yeshayahu introducing something new? Is he expounding on something that is implicit? So that's hard. But you're right. Later generations, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting question, right? Like, you know, the sectarians in the time of Chazal responded to by setting up tefillot that publicly lambasted them in shul. Right? Right? That's how Chazal say they responded. Is it possible? You know, in the Gemara, when they're talking about the tzdukim, they usually say, we do this explicitly, l'hotzi miliban shel tzdukim. Right? Like, we are doing this as a policy in order to prove the tzdukim wrong. Right? So they're pretty straightforward. So the feeling you get in the Gemara is that they're not lying. Right? They're telling you, but it's hard to figure out historically, are they telling that to us who are reading the rabbinic texts, or are they telling that to the people also, right? I don't know. That's a hard question, right? Are they telling the people that this is policy, or are they telling people it's law? That's hard to tell. The Karaites? I don't know, right? I mean, in the Karaites, we have all types of interesting things that we did, but I'm trying to think if we lie, right? Like, I was listening to a shiur by Rabbi Etshalom a few months ago, where apparently there's newer evidence that the minhag to say b'memat likin on Friday night, which talks about what you light candles with, was an anti-Karaite polemic, because since they believe that lo tivaru eish b'chol mosh v'techa means you can't have a fire going on Shabbat, and we think it means you can't light one. The rabbinic custom became to talk about how we light candles before Shabbat, going into Shabbat, so much so that at certain points there was actually a bracha that certain communities said to, like, formalize this anti-Karaite polemic. But I don't know, right? But I can't think offhand of them lying, right? They were very aggressive, but I don't know about lying. It's hard, you know, there might be an example, but I can't offhand think of it. But then again, I don't know what they were saying to people, right? Like, I don't know how they were presenting things. But you're right. That's a data point we'd have to look at.
Right, because to me, the same people who will go back to the Gemara and the origins and try and utilize that as their primary source for when they make sock, I suppose. Now they're doing something completely they don't have any precedence on.
Right. I mean, look, they might interpret certain things. I mean, I didn't read this inside. There are some mefarshim. Let me see if I put this on the sheet. Yeah. So I'll reshare it. But they do find precedent in this very interesting line, which is not clear what it means. But this is one of their main precedents. Is this? Which is, some codifiers have suggested that in order to ensure acceptance of his decision, a decisor may falsely attribute his ruling to someone greater than he, provided he is absolutely convinced of its correctness. This is known in the halachic literature as litalot b'ilan gadol, to hang your decision on a big tree. And the Magen Avraham, who's like, you know, if not the main commentary on Aruch Chaim on Shulchan Aruch, definitely one of them, actually endorses this, that you're allowed to lie and say something like, you think something's true, but no one's going to listen to you, so you say, I heard Ramosha Feinstein say. You're actually allowed to do that. And he thinks that Rabbi Kiva did that in the Gemara. So if he's right, then we have precedent. But it's very unclear whether he's right. And even the Magen Avraham, or the Magen Avraham says you can do this. Others limit it to preventing others from sinning, right? But in any case, this does not necessarily mean that it's permitted to lie by the reasons for the ruling, merely its attribution, right? So there is potential precedent in the Gemara for lying about who said something, maybe only to prevent someone from sinning, and maybe even not then. And even there, it might just be attribution to say, Moshe said it, meaning, you know, which, again, is extreme, but it's a little bit more understandable, right? Like, if someone only listens to what Moshe says, and you say, Moshe said not to, clean the stain off your shirt on Shabbos, I mean, I don't know whether Moshe ever said it. It's obviously true, because no one disagrees with it. So maybe there is precedent. Okay, but other impressions, right? What do you think? Is this legitimate? Is this desirable? Is it smart, right?
It's a very general sociological question.
Okay, good. So what does it depend on? Good, Aliza. What does it depend on?
It depends on what you think people are going to respond to. And like in my own head, I analogize it to if you would ask a group of people, if your doctor knows that that you have a terminal illness, do you want to know or not, right? People have very, very different and ingrained reactions to that, and it's very hard to convince someone who holds one view that the other view is legitimate. To me, this is kind of the same thing, right? You can have very, very ingrained reactions to, is it better to know everything that is out there, be fully informed and understand all the parameters of what's going on, versus do you want to be protected from information and just be given direct instruction and not have to think too much? And I think it's frankly an ongoing debate. I mean, I remember in high school, this was a long time ago now, I went to a fairly mainstream modern Orthodox high school, but we were invited to the Beit Yaakov convention. This was eye-opening for us because all of the texts that we learned in high school were things they had never seen before. And these girls were convinced that it was the right way to be, right? They didn't have to worry about too much. They just kind of followed, I don't want to say blindly because that's maybe a little bit too derogatory, but they were very comfortable being told what to do and not knowing what else was out there. Whereas our view was, right, I mean, the Torah can stand up to everything, so why not know what's going out there and be prepared to answer? And I feel like this is a version of the same question, right? How does that play out? What communities are you dealing with? What tools do they have? What do you think they're spending their time on? How able do you think they are to analyze what's before them? And maybe simply it's a paternalistic view versus a more open view.
Okay, so I think what Aliza said is excellent. And I twice in her, what she said, she picked up on, she invoked a very relevant parallel case, which is the medical scene. And if we leave aside the question of whether it's halakhically permitted or not, the question of whether it's a good idea, I agree with Aliza. And there's a wonderful article. When I put together the reading list of things for next week, which I promise I'll do, I'll include it, but it's on YU Torah. There was a fascinating article co-written by Rabbi Dr. Judah Goldberg, who's both a rabbi and a doctor. He works in the emergency room here in Shire Tzedek, and his wife, Shana Goldberg, who is a Yoetz at Halacha, and they joined their disciplines to write an article called Balabayit Centered Halacha, I think, which was basically using the philosophical debate in medicine over whether paternalism or informed consent or right informed patient autonomy is better. And they were using that for halakha, right? And Judah was contributing the medical side and saying, look, the arguments in favor of paternalism are If you are convinced that you have the right conclusion, so then the right, and all that matters is the conclusion, so paternalism might be the right way to go in medicine and in halakha. But if either you think that the experts are fallible or will do a better job when they're pushed, because now people are aware of what's going on and they can push for a second opinion and things like that, or more importantly, you think that there is a fundamental value to autonomy, so then even if it might turn out to be a worse medical outcome, you're still going to give the patient the choice. And they make a very important comment there, which is one of the reasons that people might think that the right thing to do is to be opaque, right? Maybe not explicitly lying, but opaque, and just sort of tell people, do this, don't do that, without explaining why, is because they have an idea that religious life is just about making sure that the most number of people do the right actions as you see fit. But maybe if you don't believe that's the value of religious life, and you actually think it's worth to have a life where you make your own decisions, it might be worth risking that people make the wrong decision if that's the price of engaging them, so that when they make the right decision, it's their own, right? So I think you're definitely right that these meta questions, right, in addition to the localized halakhic question, is it permitted, forbidden? Is it baltosif, is it not? Is it lying, is it not? The major question here is, do you think that the only thing that matters is getting someone to do the right thing, right? And then maybe the best way to do that is to just say yes, no, without explaining why? Or do you think that there's a value with people being educated consumers? I don't know, maybe that's the wrong word here, but educator consumers, let's say, of halakhic decision-making, even though you know that people who are educated might make the wrong decision from your vantage point. But you actually think religiously it's more important for them to be engaged in the process. And as Aliza correctly notes, it might depend on your community, right? It might depend on your community, their education, their inclinations. But it's a worthwhile article because I think it's just wonderfully done because it's just from the different perspectives. Shayna is contributing sort of her experience from getting Nidah Shilas from women over the years, and Judah is contributing both as a rabbi, but not necessarily one who's involved in stock, but more as a doctor who's very halakhically educated. And they really try to grapple with what's at stake here. I think that's definitely true. I'll throw something out and, you can tell me what you think. I think there's another factor, which is not just what type of community do you have, but the question of what will happen if the community finds out that you weren't being honest, right? I think that, and I've seen several posts can raise it, but I think it's sort of an intuitive point. I don't think you need to source this, that it's one thing to argue about whether you should be less than fully honest if the people you're talking to are never going to find out that you weren't being fully honest. But if all it takes, in Elisa's example, is for one of those Beit Yaakov girls for one day to Google something and discover there were other opinions, and then they feel betrayed because something was presented as the only possibility, right, the only view, it might just be that we have to be honest because people are going to figure it out. And when they find it, which is worse for people? If you tell them this isn't us, but it's a bad idea, and then they can take it or leave it, or if you tell them this is the only possible way to think and it's true according to law and there's no other perspective, and then one day they find out you're lying to them, right? Which one of them is more likely to take what you say seriously, right? My guess is the person who you were honest with. And even though you were honest and you weakened your own position, you also strengthen your hand, because when they see other opinions, they'll say, yeah, I knew there were other opinions, and either I chose to trust my authority or I didn't. And I think that's really important to realize you know, this has happened. And I'll take another question if there aren't a second, but I just want to give you an example, because last week someone said, well, rabbis never do this, right? When it comes to women's issues, it's always halacha. No one is ever honest enough to say that it's just policy. But that's not actually true. And I have here an example of Yehuda Herzl Henkin, where Yehuda Herzl Henkin wrote a very long article on partnership in Yanim. And after going through all the halacha and why he thought it's technically permitted, formally permitted, he writes as follows. Where does all of this leave us? Regardless of the arguments that can be preferred to permit women's aliyot today, that kavod ha'tzibur can be waived, that it does not apply when everyone is literate, that it does not apply when the olim rely on the male baal kriya and do not themselves read, women's aliyot remain outside the consensus, and a congregation that institutes them is not orthodox in name and will not long remain orthodox in practice. In my judgment, this is an accurate statement now and for the foreseeable future, and I see no point in arguing about it. Now, agree or disagree with Henkin, what's clear is that he thinks it's a terrible idea, and yet he doesn't try to hide it by halacha at all. He says, look, it can be mutter. I know it can be mutter. Here is the argument of why it's mutter, but I think it's wrong. I think this is not what our community needs. And I'm telling you that, right? In my judgment, this is what I think. You like it? You agree with me? You're part of my community and you want to follow my assessment of the community? Great. You don't want to? Okay, right? But he actually does, right? And a lot of people have criticized other poskim for not being honest, right? For wrapping things up in halachic language when they don't really mean it. But it can be done, right? You can be honest, right? And at the end of the day, right, I don't know which is more successful. Is it more successful to say it's usher midaraisa when no one really believes you, right? Or is it better to say, look, it could be usher, it could be mutter, but you know what? There are things beyond halacha. I don't think it's a good idea. Take it or leave it. You like it? You agree with me? Great. You don't, right? Personally, I find Rav Henkin's approach refreshing. Right? Again, regardless of the local issue, right? Whether you think he's right or wrong, right? But the fact that he's willing to say and weaken his hand, so to speak, by saying, look, it's not usser. I can't tell you it's usser. You want to do it because it's mutter? You're right. It's mutter, or arguably so, right? But I have broader perspective here, and I'm making a statement of the community. This is what I think. But he acknowledges it's my judgment policy-wise, right? So it's not impossible. Right, it really is not impossible. People do this. Poskim do this. Poskim do this. The question of whether you really can pull it off, right? And I do think that at some level it makes the conversation better, right? It makes it a real conversation, because then, you know, if you hide it behind halacha, then you can't argue about what's really at stake. If you acknowledge it's about policy, so then what you're asking is, what do I think the community should look like? So then you can argue about what you can talk about what you're actually arguing about, right? If you hide it behind halacha, your conversation isn't honest, right? If it's about policy and you acknowledge that, so then you can talk about what communal policy is and why. Okay, other things, and I do want to at least quickly get through Rav Sherlo, because I think it's very, very important, but before I do that, other comments, questions, reactions?
It causes great confusion, because policy on this side of the street is one thing, the policy across the street is something else. And what is left is the individual has to make his or her own policy decision. And that we understand the halacha, but just like Greg Henkin, I mean, he's saying it's totally mutter for a partnership opinion. But so it's left to the individual and not to the rabbi.
So Jeff highlights
our society is devolving into that.
So this is an interesting question. So Jeff says, well, okay, this is chaos, right? This is chaos because now every individual is going to make up his own decisions. and because it's not halacha. However, right, it's interesting because Jeff is making an assumption which might be right, but it touches on a huge issue, which is it really the case that rabbis only get to decide halacha, right? Like, if you ask a Haredi person, they'll tell you no. It's specifically on non-halachic issues that rabbis are even more important. That's called Das Torah, right? Right? So I think that many people who grew up in the modern Orthodox community, myself included, the second it's not halacha, and someone acknowledges that, you say, okay, so I have more leeway, right? Because it's not halacha. But that might not be true, right? And this gets to a much more important question, which is, okay, even if it's not halacha, do rabbis have a say in what's not halacha? Right? What is the role of rabbis in policy? And this is really the Das Torah, right, firestorm. Right? The reason everyone's so angry about this is because those are specifically issues that are not local to halacha. It's like meta questions where, and I think it's telling that I think in the Haredi community, they're more willing to accept a diversity of view on halacha than they are on policy, right? Right, when it comes to halacha, I think they'll tell you, oh, you're a Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein? Okay, so you shouldn't carry in the Eruv in Brooklyn. Oh, you're a Talmud of Rav Menashe Klein? Okay, so you can carry in the Eruv in Flatbush, right? But if the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah comes out and says, you know, whatever, smartphones are usher, right? Right? There's no room for debate because policy, ironically, becomes more important than halacha, right? Halacha, there can be a machlokes, but policy, they give over to the gedolim. And that's why, you know, this question of policy in Pesach opens up a Pandora's box because the implicit question we have to ask, as Jeff picks up on, is, okay, but what is the role of the rabbinate in non-halachic issues? Meaning, does a rabbi, right, because Rav Henkin, for example, thinks that it is his right to at least say his policy position, right? But I'm sure there are many people who say, I agree with Rav Henkin on halacha, but Mechilat Kvot Toreto, he's a posik, he's not a politician, right? He's not a, right? Whereas other people might say, no. It's specifically when it comes to policy issues, we have to go to the Gedolim. And that's why, right, the Das Torah question, which is to what areas of decision-making do we turn to halachic authorities, is one of the next logical questions you have to ask, right? Because Jeff makes an assumption that I may share, may not, right? I won't maybe put my cards on the table, right? But I definitely share it at least somewhat. But there are definitely people in the Orthodox community who don't share that at all, right? If anything, they go to the opposite extreme. But you're also right that it may lead to anarchy in general, right? Meaning one of the dangers here is that an educated laity with honest poskim, right, opens the door to a lot more diversity and a lot of people who just don't go the way you want them to, right? But I think as Judah and Shana point out in their article, do you think that's a problem, right? If you think the ideal goal is to create an educated community of people who engage in Dvar Hashem for themselves, then maybe that's not a problem, right? Maybe it's okay to say, you know what, as long as they're in really, really, and I have a lot of friends who do things that I think that I really disagree with, but if they have spent the time thinking about it and they've learned the sugya and they have their own rabbis, whether or not I agree with them, I'm happy that they have committed lives. I'd rather them have a committed life, right, that is based in really trying to figure out what God wants through Torah and everything, than come to a radically different conclusion than me, than live a life that looks identical to mine just because, you know, someone told them to, right? But that's my personal preference. Right? Not everyone will agree with that. Some people think the only thing that matters is getting to the right decision, however you define that. Okay, so let me quickly make another point. We said Tehillim for a few minutes, so I'll take an extra few minutes here because we started a little bit late, which was important. But I do want to do this, because I think that this is really an amazing article by Rav Sherlo. Rav Yuval Sherlo is a leading voice in the religious Zionist world in Israel, a bit more on the left of the spectrum, but a very, very thoughtful, popular voice in general, even acknowledged by those who disagree with him. I mean, he was asked to weigh in when the government wanted to set policy for whether or not we should allow parents to choose the sex of their child when doing IVF. And this is something that governments are really worried about because it's a slippery slope to eugenics in the most extreme sense, or just in the gender, just in the sex sense, in the, you know, like the outcome of the China one child policy kind. So, for example, in America, there's no limitations whatsoever. You're allowed to choose the sex of your child as you see fit. In Canada, if you do it, it carries up to a $500,000 fine and a 10-year prison sentence. Just to give you an idea of how divergent different countries' policy on this are. In Israel, it's much more complicated. But they wanted to know, what do you do? And Sherlo wrote this brilliant article where he said, look, this is not a halachic question in the classic sense. It's a policy question. It's a slippery slope question, which is, for certain people, there's no problem with them choosing the sex of their child. Let's take an easy case, right? Someone knows that he has a serious disease that's carried on the Y chromosome. So he only wants that girl so that his children don't have his serious illness, okay? Right, this happens all the time. That's not like that's relatively not controversial. But once you open the door, it could lead to eugenics. So he said, aha, this is a slippery slope question. The rabbis know how to deal with slippery slope. So here's my suggestion of how to create religiously inspired policy. And he basically boils down all of halacha into three policies. And he said, the rabbis take into account three things when they want to figure out whether a policy is a good policy or a bad policy. One, he calls sikui in Hebrew. In English, it's the likelihood of the undesired result. How likely is it that if you ban someone from choosing to only have a girl because he has a Y chromosome linked disease, that will lead to eugenics? The higher the likelihood of the bad result, the more likely it's legitimate to have a strict policy. Where does he get this from in Chazal? From Milta de lo shchicha lo gazer be'rabanan. From the rabbi's statement that they don't set up rabbinic laws for rare instances. He said, you see that the rabbis think it's only worth having strict policy for things that are common. But if it happens once in a lifetime, it's not worth imposing on people who have legitimate reasons to do something that fundamentally is allowed just because you want to prevent some dangerous thing down the road. Rule one. Rule two, what he calls sikun. How bad would it be if it happened? Meaning, okay, eugenics, that's bad. Okay. So, but other things might not be as bad, right? I mean, whatever, take your pick. And he said, how do I know that Chazal think that it's more legitimate to have strict policy when what you fear will happen is bad than when it's not? So he said, very simple. Chazal say, ein gozrim gzeira l'gzeira. You only set up rabbinic law to protect biblical law, but not rabbinic law. Because violating biblical law is bad enough, it's worth setting up protective policies. But violating rabbinic law isn't. And therefore the rabbis don't protect their own laws. So you see that the less high stakes the end result is, the less it's worth to set a policy that's restrictive. Furthermore, he said that in certain poskim, they allow you to set up double second order of zero if what you're trying to prevent down the road is really, really bad, like karet. The third thing he says is mechir. Every time you set a policy and say that something that should be permitted, we're going to treat as if it's forbidden, there's a cost to the quality of life in the here and now. And he said, Chazal think, from the fact that we know that Chazal sometimes don't make their takanot in cases of monetary loss, you see that Chazal say, look, just because something's dangerous doesn't mean it's worth impinging on someone's freedom in the present. And therefore, in order to set up halakhically inspired policy, if you're going to do it, you got to balance three factors. How bad will it be if this actually slips down to the bottom of that slope? How likely is that to happen? And what are the costs to the people's lives in the here and now by telling them they can't do something that fundamentally is permitted? Those are the three factors you need to take into account to figure out whether a restrictive policy is a good idea or not. Right? And like, since we were already talking about the women's issues, I'll just quickly say, you see this all the time, right? When people say, look, I think that women's learning is a good idea, but it might end up, wherever you think it's going to end up, right? When people push back, some people will push back and say, yes, but if you allow women to learn Torah, that deepens their religious life now, and it's worth the risk, right? That's a claim that maybe you're right that it might lead to something dangerous, but it's not worth the cost to stop something which is intrinsically valuable. Other people will say, what are you worried about? You're worried about that the people who are claiming they're learning Torah, it's really because they're driven by some anti-halachic feminist agenda, right? What are the chances that learning Torah is really going to lead to what you think? These are committed people, right? They want to learn Torah. They don't want to do X, Y, and Z, right? And some people will say, okay, and if they do, so what? So some people will end up at places that you don't like? Okay, that happens, right? Right? But is it really the end of the world such that you're going to tell all well-meaning people that they can't learn Torah just because you're worried that it might lead to something else? Or maybe it will, right? Maybe it won't. But how do you really think that's the greatest threat to Judaism, right? All these arguments are the type of arguments people make, right? Meaning even if you're making a policy, it needs to be halakhically inspired. And that's what Shurlo tries to give you, is a language for figuring out if you're going to do something on policy grounds, how do you formulate a good policy and how do you formulate a bad, dangerous, over-exaggerated, overly ambitious policy that ends up doing more harm in the here and now than what it's trying to prevent. And that's equally important, right? Besides for being honest, when you're making the policy decision, you got to make sure it's a good policy decision, right? And that's really hard, right? And what Rav Shurlo gives us, I think, is a very helpful language to think about what makes something a good policy and what makes it an exaggerated response that hurts people in the present. Just because you're afraid of some scary future down the road. Okay, now, even with my Tehillim time, I've filled up my time, so I will stick around for questions, comments, responses, and then Malki and I will come up with the last topic, at least before Shavuot. I do hope that we get to learn again in the future, because I've enjoyed this a lot, and there's so much more to say. But I will try to get together a reading list, so that we'll at least ensure the conversation goes on, if not between us directly, between, amongst yourselves or with you in your head with these authors. So I will try to do that. But for now, last questions, comments, responses, thoughts, etc. Okay, I see some people want to talk, but they're holding themselves back. You don't have to hold yourself back. I won't call anyone by name because I don't want to pressure anyone. But I do see people on the verge of saying something.
And I always have something to say. But I was going to text you about that. But I have a lot of questions on the freedom of decision-making and our choices. I mean, I've been learning a lot about our freedom, personal freedoms of choices of how we should understand and find God ourselves. So if you're told what to do and you don't really make that decision I wouldn't say on your own with all the full knowledge, is that, like, again, look at Abraham's journey. You know, he didn't have anyone to direct him or give him anything. And you know, we each have our own personal journeys that we take, I suppose, to your point. So I guess, I mean, that's my one of my thoughts. And then the other one we can talk about, you know, is when it says policy is more important than halacha. I mean, is that again something that I missed?
Right. So like I said, you know, the thing I've learned about when you talk about halachic, you know, halacha and like the broad thing is, it just everywhere you turn, it opens up a can of worms. And you're right. Meaning, I think I grew up firmly in the modern Orthodox community. You know, that no, like halacha was really important. And policy is important, but halacha is always supreme. But there's been a lot of work pointing out that that's not really what, that not everyone agrees to that, right? And again, I really do think, you know, like I like to give the following example, right? And this, if this resonates with you, right, you'll understand what I mean. How many people do you know, right? If you'd ask me in a vacuum, what is more important? A question of Hilchot Shabbat, which is, in the end of the day, a capital offense if you violate Shabbat, or a Dirabbanan, right? I would say, obviously, it's more important to protect Shabbat. Except, if I then pose to you an actual case, and I say, which of the following do people get more heated about? Whether or not you're allowed to make tea on Shabbat, where the Mishnah Brura and the Aruch HaShulchan both say that if you do, you get the death penalty, right? Both of them, the two major posts from the 20th century, both say you get the death penalty. But Moshe Feinstein says, no, it's fine, right? Right? So that's like big stakes, and yet I know a lot of people who, when I tell them, the Mishnah Brura and the Aruch HaShulchan both say you can't make tea on Shabbos, they've never heard of it. They're like, no, it can't be. I know all these from people make tea. I was like, yeah, because Moshe argued on them, which is fine. But you understand that this is a question that, at least on paper, is one of life and death, right? Or whether women can get aliyot, which the whole halacha to begin with is derabanan. So it's impossible to argue this is anything but derabanan, because to begin with it's a derabanan halacha. The worst that'll happen, presumably, is that you didn't fulfill your mitzvah derabanan, right? And 100% of people, I think, will tell me that people get more heated about the second one, right? The first one, no one even knows it's a machloket. If they do, they don't care. They're like, okay, you want to make tea? You don't want to make tea. You want to do it with essence? You want to do it with a tea bag? Yeah, everyone has their rabbi, right? It's misa. It's like it's a death penalty case, right? But women's issues, right? Like, the number of people who texted me because they heard that there's a woman rabbi in Efrat, right? is far more than the number of people who have complained to me that, you know, about whether or not I make tea on Shabbos, right? Far more. And this is not even my side, it's not even my community, right? I live in the same city, right? And I've gotten people texting me, oh, did you hear what happened in Efrat? I'm like, why did that elicit such a response that people are angry? And I was like, I have no idea. I mean, disagree. Why did that get? But we know that that's actually the case, right? Right. Rabbis who will be silent on halachic questions suddenly, when it comes to a policy, right, or a derabanan or whatever, which they see that it stands in for a identity of the community question, right? No, ask the Gedolim. The Gedolim are against it. I mean, sure, the Gedolim were, until Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Gedolim were also against making tea on Shabbos. And you don't see anyone holding rallies against, right, making tea on Shabbos, right? So you might be, Malki, you might be right that this is a wrong approach to life. But I think descriptively, it's actually the way a lot of people function. And once you realize that, then you realize, oh, like, that's really what's at stake in, like, the Das Torah Machlokas, right? Is it really the case? Maybe policy is more important than localized halakhic issues, right? I mean, look, mechitza was the defining issue between the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement, even more in many ways than driving on Shabbos, right? Because there are Chabad shuls which encourage people to come to shul however they get there, right? Even if they drive but are Orthodox, right? And there were conservative shuls in Toronto that I knew that were like old school conservative where people still kept Shabbos and walked to shul. And yet one of those is called Orthodox and one of those is not, right? Even though driving to shul is clearly a worse violation than being in a shul without a mechitza. Whatever you think about the mechitza, that's clearly not as bad as driving on Shabbos, right? So it might be ironic, but on the other hand, I think it's also true that a lot of people have the intuition that, that policy is at some level more important. It might be wrong, but that's definitely the way people treat it.
Right, but it's so interesting because policy would have been something that is pretty new in the spectrum of Judaism, policy being more important than halakha. And yet they are against anything that's social, and it came about because of social, you know, I guess, motifs and things like that, from what I understand. And yet they are so against anything that's doing because of social motifs.
100%. 100%. And that's why, look, Benny Brown wrote an excellent, very long article on how Das Torah came in. And look, this is why Das Torah is such a heated question, because this is really the meta question is, do rabbis have some magic place in non-halachic issues, right? That's really what's at stake here. And it is pretty new, admittedly. It is new in its modern form. You know, Benny Brown's article, I think, goes to like four stages of how it developed to look like it does in the modern, scene. And yeah, going back to the other point, I think you're right. One of the major questions here, you know, we talked about this as being possibly what we talk about, maybe we can still do it next week, of, you know, one of the other questions that's raised here is, okay, well, how do I paskin for myself? You know, in halacha, in policy, when can I? And I'm, you know, my opinion, you know, my personal opinion is that, yeah, like, you know, my misara from Hyderabayim, from Rav Lichtenstein, is that paskin for yourself, you know, I'm not going to give it all away now, but... But it is some level of sliding scale. And if you're educated, definitely on minor issues, there's a value to you making your decision. Right? I mean, the more of an expert you are, the more things you can make decisions for yourself. But there's actually a positive value to that. Because, yeah, you're on your own journey in that sense. And at the end of the day, you're responsible. I agree not everyone will agree to that. But I do think that it's an important question. And it's an important thing to realize that... you know, stock is not just for who we classically think of post-game, especially since a lot of halakhic questions are not stock in the formal sense either, right? In stock in general, things that are found in books, that are like widely found in books, are not always considered stock because it's just a question of looking things up. Stock is usually a new question. You know, and a lot of things, I think there's a value. Why do you need, right? If you are educated and you can open up the basic svarim, you know, I think it's important that people have that skill, right? And I don't, you know, I'm pretty open to people having different opinions. I mean, even in my house, right, people are sometimes surprised. But like, you know, Ora and I don't talk in the same on a lot of things, right? We just don't, right? We have different opinions, either personal or different rebbeim. And I'm fine with that. I want my kids to know that, right? I want them to know that we don't have to have the same, you know, the same opinion and everything. I want them to understand they can make their own decisions. I don't need my kids to follow my psakim, right? You know, I do think that's valuable. You know, I have all types of my own weird opinions, right? I don't need my kids to follow them. I do them because I believe in them. And I follow the halacha as I understand it, which sometimes diverges from the way other people understand it. They're like, well, what are your kids going to think? I'm like, my kids are going to think that people have different opinions and that's okay. Like, what is bad about that? That sounds good to me. Like, you know, I want them to grow up that way.
Don't want to keep anyone. So I feel like if everyone has, and I'm sure people are still mulling all this over because there's a lot, but if you have a comment or an email, please, you can either send it directly to Rabbi Ziering, you can send it to me and I can pass it on to Rabbi Ziering, because I think that there's a lot.
There is definitely a lot to digest. So yeah, but please do. And I will not start preparing the Makarot for next week until I hear from Malki. I'll give everyone a day or two to mull it over. because, you know, again, I hope we get to learn again in the future, but, you know, I think for this series, next week is our last one, unfortunately, and then we go into Shavuot. Think of which of these topics that sort of has been opened here you want to address in our last week, and, you know, otherwise email me, and I'll try to get a reading list together, either, you know, for next class or after next class based on whatever comes up in our conversation, but either by next Sunday or probably after next Sunday, after, you know, our last class, and I get a feel of what else should be on that list. Okay. Anyways, well, thanks everyone for coming. I look forward to your comments, either directly or through Malki. And as we said at the beginning, you know, hopefully our learning will be l'refua shlema and l'ilui nishmat, and, you know.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good week, everyone.